Thanks very much, Dave. Go ahead, please.
Thank you very much, Ken. My name is Dave. I'm an addict. I want to thank you very much for asking me to come out and talk to you about how I do this program, share my experience, strength, and hope, and hopefully say something that catches somebody off guard or sounds profound, or maybe it just sounds dumb, but it may change your life someday. Who the heck knows? Let's try it. Why not? Matt, welcome here. Glad that you just happened upon this wonderful meeting here, and I have the honor of meeting you for the first time. And I hope that it meets your needs most definitely. So I'm very glad that you're here, and welcome to everybody else. It's good to see all my friends here, and new and old. And I recently have been, when I talk about my experience, strength, and hope, the most important part of that is definitely my getting to Narcotics Anonymous, and how that was for me. Some of you have heard me share this, but just bear with me. The last several months of my using, time was so irrelevant in that period of my life, but I assume it was about a year of my using. I had gotten to a place in my life where I had burned absolutely everybody out. My life was controlled by needing to be the center of attention. I had this big, huge, gaping hole inside. I had this feeling of just emptiness, of never quite being enough, and constantly trying to figure out ways to fill that hole inside here. And I had basically been kicked out of every single place that I had ever gone to, for several years before I made it to Narcotics Anonymous. And that's everything from jobs to relationships to family dynamics to clubs that I would hang out with, trying to be the rock star that I thought I was. And so I would just like go into a situation. I knew that it was a lot easier to get negative attention than it was positive attention. So it would be what I call the S, the strangest, the craziest, the weirdest, the stupidest, the smartest. I would try to be different than the people around me. So eyes would be on me, because when I was playing the actor, the fool, the clown, I didn't have to think about what was going on inside of me. I was always thinking about how I was impressing you, or thought I was impressing you. And that's how my life manifested itself throughout my drug use. And I had finally gotten to the place where I couldn't handle being around, the crowds that I was hanging out with. And I started hanging out in one of the seedier parts in Sacramento, and hanging out with the hustlers and the hookers, and started for the first time smoking crack. And it became everything to me. It became, we talk about it in some of the readings that we read in the traditional meetings, the getting and using and finding ways and means to get more. And that's when that really sank in for me, for my drug use. I lived to use and use to live, because I could have a big pile of it in front of me and it wouldn't matter. I would be thinking about what I would do at 4 in the morning during tweakers hours, on whether or not I was going to go to that house on Belden Street, in that crazy area, and not get shot trying to get some more drugs. And it really had gotten to the place where I was so obsessed with getting loaded and making sure that I always had it, that I couldn't even enjoy anything that was in front of me. My mom taught at a college here in Sacramento, and she had gone out of state for on a sabbatical. And when she came back into town, she tried to get a hold of me. Now, this was back in 1989, so it was when cell phones weighed no less than 3 pounds, so, and they were also really, really expensive. So I didn't have one, and the only way that anybody got a hold of me was by one of those rotary phones, the phones. You guys remember those? Anyway, and I didn't want, I knew that she was calling me. I talked to her a couple times over that year period, but I tried desperately not to connect with her, because my mom was my higher power. Literally, she was the person who I both respected and resented more than anybody. I knew that she cared a lot about me and she wanted to see the best for me, but I didn't like the way she showed me that. And I was constantly rebellious, and I rebelled against that attitude that she was once again the authority in my life that I wasn't willing to give, to bow down to, and to give respect to. But after several months, finally one day, she called me and she caught me at home, and I answered the phone and she said, "I need to see you tonight. I need to see that you're okay, and I want you to come over for dinner." And I went over to her house that night, and on the way over there, I was driving and thought to myself, "Well, maybe we can have dinner and she just won't look me in the face and I'll get away with it, you know." But I got over to her condo and I went into through the garage, and the garage opened up into the kitchen, and she was cooking up against the stove. And I slithered by her onto the patio. And I remember saying a couple things to her, thinking, "Well, maybe I will get away with this and she just won't see me." But unfortunately, when she turned around, she dropped the spatula out of her hand, her jaw hit the ground, and she said, "What is wrong with you, David?" And I started talking out of both sides of my neck, thinking that I was going to get away with something, saying, "I've just been working really hard," and blah, 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 whatever I could think of to get away from the fear that I had of her figuring out that I was a drug addict. But there are probably a few of you, I know a few of you who are moms, and we all have had moms. We all know the mom stare, you know, the mom stare that goes through like three buildings, you know, hits you right in the forehead and nails you. And the dike opened up and I just started bawling. I just started bawling because I just didn't know what to do at that point. It was that, you know, that fear that that I had been figured out. I was just really afraid, and I told her that I, you know, had been really having a problem with drugs, and I thought she was going to make everything okay and take me under her wing. But she had been doing them tough love meetings that were big back in the 80s, and she said, "What are you going to do about it?" And I had to think really fast, so I quickly said, my sister, who had been going to some meetings for her eating issues, had some friends down in Berkeley who were going to Narcotics Anonymous, and she said, "Then call them." And I went to my first meeting that night. I don't even think I ate dinner. I think I just went. And I remember getting to the meeting a little bit late because don't you know who I am? I'm really important, and I am assuming that everybody was going to give me a standing ovation when I walked in the door for showing up. But unfortunately, only a few people looked at their watches and said, "Hello, you're late," you know, one of those things. And I remember it was one of the big meetings here in Sacramento, probably about 150 people in the room. And this was back in 89, so it was the happening meeting, no doubt. And I remember that kind of tripping on the fact that everybody was kind of looking in one direction. And I hadn't been in a room with more than three people where there weren't at least two conversations to go on. So I didn't understand what was happening, but everybody was paying attention to something that was going on at the front of the room. So I looked up front. And remember, I had gotten loaded for a couple of days before this had happened. But my impression was the guy at the front of the room who was talking was 8 foot 9, weighed about 920 pounds. He had swastikas on both sides of his neck and white pride written down his arm right here. And being Jewish, I'm thinking I probably just walked into the wrong meeting. I'm not sure. But then I remember that I had a Jewish mother who just told me to go to this meeting, and that scared me a lot more than this scary looking guy. So I sat down and started listening to what this guy was talking about. And I heard a lot of what I needed to hear to keep me here for the last 36 years. And that's the fact that he shared his experience, the fact that he used to hurt people for a living, and I didn't have any problems believing that. And then he talked about his strength, the fact he'd have been clean for 3.5 years, and he had gone to at least a meeting a day for every single one of those 3.5 years, sometimes as many as four meetings. And then he hooked me with the hope, the fact that all he got from people when he go to these meetings is they just wanted to make sure that he was going to be okay. They didn't want anything else from him. They didn't ask him for money, or they didn't ask him for jobs. They didn't do anything other than just want to see him be okay. And at that point, I knew that this is what I had been looking for my whole entire life. And all that negative behavior, negative attention that I tried to get, all I wanted was just somebody to say, "I hope you're okay," and really mean it. And I knew that I was home. And after trying it for a couple of days, going out and getting loaded a couple more times, I was able to come back in the middle of July at 89 and stick around. And the first 90 days of my recovery were really challenging because I was terribly overamped. I was manic. It was very difficult for me to sit down. On a good day, if I could sit down for 30 seconds, that was a really, really calm day for me. And I'd be in a meeting and somebody would be talking about something really serious, like a breakup or loss of a job, or somebody was ill or somebody just passed away. And of course, we learned compassion around here. But at that point in my life, I knew the definition of compassion. I knew the definition of patience and tolerance, but I knew nothing about them. And everything that would be coming to mind, because my mind twisted everything into something weird and funny, and it would come flying out of my mouth. And half the room would be laughing uncontrollably, and the other half would be getting ready to take care of me after the meeting. But no, not really. The most important part about those first 90 days is nobody ever told me that I wasn't welcome in Narcotics Anonymous, ever. In fact, they told me to keep coming back. They remembered my name. And that was something that I wasn't used to. I wasn't used to that at all. And I knew that this was something really special here, and that people just wanted to see me be okay. And it's something that's really important in my recovery today than when there's somebody in the room who's struggling and having a difficult time with trauma or mental health issues or anything at all whatsoever, and it's hard for them to sit on their hands and sit still. I try to do everything in my power, particularly in person. It's a little bit more difficult online, but definitely in person, to pull them outside and spend time with them until they can, calm down enough to come back in the room, because that's what people did for me. And how important that is, the message that the only requirement for membership is the desire to stop using. So what can we do when that person doesn't know anything more about the protocol or how we act in recovery, or doesn't have the ability to act in a civil way? And how do we keep them from leaving and not coming back, and more than likely going out and dying? So that first 90 days was incredibly important to me in my recovery. And about 90 days, I was able to get some su support, get some outside help that I needed. We didn't have really cool literature like in times of illness and medications in the NA group, and mental health in Narcotics Anonymous, but we had some people who really did understand and learn and practice the traditions of Narcotics Anonymous. That when there were people who said you can't take anything, you can stay clean without anything, which was a big deal back in the late 80s, early 90s, that those people were the ones who took me aside and said, "That's not true. That's not what we do here. We're not professionals in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, and we don't have the right to tell people how to run their recovery. That we need to go to a doctor when we need a doctor. We need to do things that don't necessarily line up exactly with the tenets of Narcotics Anonymous." And I was able to survive. I was able to get to a place where I was able to start working the program. I start working the steps. And what I got from working the steps was that I cannot control my drug use once I start using. I cannot control. I am obsessive and compulsive in everything I do. If I'm not focused on that, and if I don't try to do something to change that, I'm not a piece of shit, and I'm not the superstar that I thought think I am. That I'm just part of a much bigger picture than I am, and the community of Narcotics Anonymous has really helped me to just be a part of a much bigger thing than me, and that I had an opportunity to take a look at the things that I wanted to change myself, and then make decisions on whether or not I was going to go ahead and make those changes. So working the steps in a secular way for me, I spent a lot of time on those first after those 90 days for the first year, kind of spending some time taking a look at what people said. Well, take a look, try to figure out what your higher power is, And I went to a couple churches, a couple temples, a couple, of ashrams and all kinds of different places to figure it out. And after a time, I realized that it just was not connecting with me. That I realized that my dad was an atheist also, and that that was just a part of who I am. And that I could figure out how to do this thing if I would just not have to concern myself with what other people thought about me and my recovery, that I didn't have to take on thinking that I can't talk about the fact that I don't have a God in my life and not worry about whether or not somebody is going to tell me that I don't belong here. I had already gone through that with the medication issue, so I was ready for that when I came about and started working and working the steps. And I had a sponsor who was incredibly patient and tolerant and compassionate and full of love, and never questioned my relationship with the higher power. He just helped me to cultivate the fact that I was an atheist, and that I was okay recognizing that the spiritual principles that I was starting to learn in Narcotics Anonymous, that love, that compassion, the love, the brotherly love, the integrity, and all the things that we learn around here, really are the things that I attain to live up to. And those are what I consider to be my higher power, or what I call my higher self. And that way, it's something I know that I will never get to that level where I'm just exactly where I want to be. So I always have something to look forward to and look up to. And when I do things that I'm not proud of, or that I would love to take back, some of you know that my favorite t-shirt says, "I wish my mouth had a backspace key," because I have a tendency to say things that I would love to take back. That I can be okay with where I'm at, because I have all these tools that I've learned from working the steps of Narcotics Anonymous. I've been able to go through the steps and not have to connect myself with a deity or anything outside myself. That I've been really okay with taking responsibility for my recovery and my actions. And I utilize the people in the program and the people who I respect and their recovery to help me when I need some support and I need some suggestions and I need some ways of handling situations that I haven't handled or dealt with before. But the more that I hang around here, the more I realize that I've become pretty okay at dealing with really difficult stuff, but it's still the small stuff that I have a real problem with. So I, as many of you know, I went through cancer from November of 24. I didn't really struggle that much with it. I still showed up. I didn't make a big deal out of it. I just kind of went through it, and it was something that was a part of my life. It was life on life's terms. But if somebody cuts me off when I'm driving, I need to let them know, and I will chase, still to this day, will have to go up and say something to them. And it's so dangerous, and it's so negative. It's such a negative effect of what I've learned around here in Narcotics Anonymous. So I continue to come back here because of the small stuff, because of those things that most people would say are no big deal. Those are the things that drive me. But I'm able to also help other people who are going through trauma or difficult situations by sharing my experience, strengthen hope with them as I get to that next place, and when they're dealing with something that they've never dealt with before. It's such an incredible program. It's a program of interdependence. We depend on one another. And the one thing that I've learned more than anything is, I don't count how many times I've helped somebody, and I don't expect to for another person who's a part of my life to count how many times I help them. I help people when they need help, and I ask for help when I need it. And I really think that that's the ultimate way of living life, is being in a place where I'm not keeping score, I'm not putting things, not checking off boxes and making sure that somebody paid me back. But I continue to be in a process of paying things forward as I continue to learn more about myself and more about the program. So with that, I'd like to thank you once again for letting me share, and I'm really looking forward to hearing from you guys. Thanks.